financial goal. If you missed your chance to donate during the drive, just go to kboo.fm right now and make your contribution. If you did pledge and still need to send us your payment, please aim to do so this week. Thanks very much again to everyone who values KBOO and helps keep it on the air.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is David Bedrick. David is a process work therapist. He's a teacher and writer and also a family law lawyer. He writes a column for the Huffington Post and for Psychology Today, and he's the author of Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. So welcome to Madness Radio, David Bedrick.
Thanks, Will. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
And David, I'm really inspired to have you on the show because I want to really go into this question of what is power, what is privilege? This is something that isn't spoken about in psychology. It's not something that therapists or mental health professionals are really trained to think in terms of oppression and social justice and power. And yet it's completely there all the time in the therapeutic profession. And you've written a really intriguing book where you challenge the way in which mainstream pop psychology, represented by Dr. Phil, the television psychologist celebrity, how his whole approach just completely ignores the power and social justice issues involved with the people that he's working with. So it's great to have you on the show. This contradiction, this complexity of power and voice and representation, it really comes in your work in family law, that you were involved with a lot of divorce proceedings, for example, and you had a very unique perspective on that. Tell us about that.
In Portland, Oregon, and some other cities have this, but not many, the judges are empowered to appoint an attorney to represent the child. Now, some people know the term guardian ad litem, like if a kid gets arrested. This is very different. This says, let's imagine that people have enough funds, which is another issue because many people don't have funds and don't have lawyers at all. But let's imagine that there's two parents, both parents have attorneys. The child usually doesn't have an attorney, almost never does. No one says, I'm representing that child, their needs, their interests. So the cultural assumption, and the courts go along with that, is that the parents and the courts, a bunch of adults, will know what's best for the child. Well, they may actually know a heck of a lot, and we certainly need their voice. But what about the child's knowledge, even if they can't say it quite as easily or as understandably to an adult? What about their knowledge, their experience that says, this is what I might need? How does that come in? Well, often it comes in indirectly through psychologists, maybe. But my job was to represent themselves so I could go into court and examine and cross-examine people. If the parents didn't have the interest of the child at heart, and those were the cases that I got involved in, they were always the worst of the worst, then I could try to bring in that point of view or challenge a parent's point of view or challenge a counselor's point of view with what I knew about a child. So I'm thinking about one case where there was a parent who thought he knows best what would be good for his children, and it would be best for them to move and spend more time with him. And the children were older, they were in their early teens, and they, most of their life was involved in their school and their friends and their clubs afterwards. So they spent most of their day wrapped up with their friends in school. But father, from his point of view, thought the best thing is for the kids to be closer to him. He was not only an easy character. So I'll just mention that in the background. But I listened to the kids. I went to their school. I talked to their teachers. I looked at their grades. It looked like school was the best place they had in their lives, right? Neither parent were they really thriving under. But in school, they had friends and they enjoyed themselves and they did things that were interesting. In fact, they often wanted to do so many extracurricular activities because they didn't want to come home, right? Because their home was difficulty. So I ended up advocating for those kids to stay wherever they could continue going to the same school. That was their position. The father didn't like that idea. Didn't think that was very good. And I ended up having him on the stand in court and questioning him about his level of trust for his kid's judgment in front of a judge, such that the judge can see that this parent had their own interest, not the child's interest, at heart.
And your legal representation was based on talking with the children and really getting a sense of their perspective, which maybe is not something that was always included in the whole process, as each side in the battle kind of lined up to get its interests advanced.
That's exactly right. So I would be connected to and representing and forwarding the kid's interest. I would get to interview the parents as well, but not sort of not with the orientation of how do I advocate for them, but to see if they get it. Do you get your children? Because I could, as a counselor too, say this is where your kids are coming from. What if your kids said this or that? What if they say they'd rather stay in the same school? And I could see their reactions to that. So I could begin to read them also and give them feedback or their lawyer's feedback to try to influence that system by, again, bringing in the voice that would have the least power in the system, which is going to be the children's.
Do you think that's really key, David, when we're talking about social justice and privilege and oppression issues, that we're really talking about voice and what person's voice is included, what person's voice is excluded?
I'm thinking of a client I worked with in my counseling practice. The mother brought her son, I think he was about 8, and he had gotten in trouble in school a number of times. And on the public transportation association or something, he had spit at a bus driver, and then he cursed out another bus driver. And he had other situations in schools where he acted inappropriately in certain situations. And when I sat with this kid and talked to him about this one bus driver, which was the last, it was one of the straws that was breaking the camel's back. They were going to have him expelled from school. I asked him about the bus driver. And interestingly enough, this bus driver didn't like certain people. He didn't like people who were physically disabled. He was very cranky and nasty with them and grumpy with them. He didn't like black-looking people and Hispanic-looking people and treated them badly. And this kid didn't know what to do other than spit at him. So in that way, could say his spitting needed words. He needed to learn to poo, but the spit itself was going to get him to a lot of trouble. So was going to eventually be his voice in saying, I disagree with this bus driver. I want to sound off to him. But this was the beginning of this person's voice. If we only said, this is a bad kid, he's acts inappropriate, let's stop him from spitting, and didn't consider the possibility that he had a voice and was speaking up for other people, then we would miss something really beautiful about this person, which could potentially grow into his career or his calling or what would be meaningful to him in his life.
So this is something that we talk about quite a bit on Madness Radio, that behaviors or ways of communicating or states of consciousness that are difficult or disruptive or painful that sometimes you might just want to get rid of, that you just say, look, this is a symptom, this is a disorder, that actually if you put it in context, it makes a lot of sense, that it's coming from somewhere, it's actually got a purpose, it's got a message behind it. If you can get into the deeper set of surrounding environmental factors that are involved. And so I think it really resonates with that. But I think that also, the other side would come in and say, well, look, wait a second. What about personal responsibility? And, you're talking about privilege, you're talking about social justice, you're talking about voice and oppression. But isn't there a basic line that says you have to behave responsibly, you have to be responsible for yourself, and you can't use a so-called social justice framework to explain away the responsibility that people have for their own behavior?
Yeah, it's a really important discussion that you're bringing up. Certainly that voice, that opinion and orientation belongs also. So in some way we could say it was good that someone stops this kid and doesn't say, go ahead, spit. We're fine with you. We understand, right? Somebody has to stop him in this story. It's good that somebody polices, as it were, stops him, says that's not okay. But then now that we've stopped him, now that we've put him in a temporary prison in a way, right, we're not going to let you do some certain things. You are unfree to act in certain ways, dear youngster. That's his momentary prison, that lack of freedom. Then while we're in that prison, when we have him locked in that place, can we do something that is really going to help that particular problem? we know in the prison system, the recidivism rate, people go back out and do many of the same things, or people end up more jaded, less able to function in society, many people, than they ever did. So the hope that this system that stops the person, which we need, but the hope that system is now going to rehabilitate a person or transform them, highly unlikely. So we need both. Something should stop the person, take away certain freedoms, in this case spitting. But then while we have taken away their freedoms, hopefully we can delve into things and find a solution that might be more sustainable, right, than what we're going to find by just saying we're going to keep you in prison. Otherwise, we have a prison system, basically, inside and out and in families.
I think that's really intriguing, David, because I think that sometimes, you know, with an emphasis on meaning and understanding context and really getting a sense of where something is coming from, I think that a lot of the Mad Pride movement or people who are interested in a different view and a different way of working with psychosis can get accused of, well, you're really just indulging people. You're really just romanticizing this. You're really just sort of saying that it's not a problem, that people just need to get over it and accept the fact that someone is, you know, doing things that are very, very self-destructive or very, very problematic or causing all kinds of problems for the people that they're living with. And what you're saying is actually the emphasis should be on bringing the voices in and creating a relationship between them and not just pushing away, locking away, putting it in that prison, but not also just rebelling, that actually you need a relationship between all the different voices that are involved in the situation.
That's well said. I'm thinking of a woman, this would be a good example, that I worked with. She loved caramel lattes, big giant ones with whole milk and caramel and all this stuff. And they were, I don't know how many calories. They were a lot of calories. I'm wanting to say 600-700, but I don't remember really a number, but it was a lot. So caramel lattes were the culprit, right? We have to stop the caramel lattes for her to get a body that she would find more acceptable, or maybe the culture would find more acceptable. So my question then, so you could say the rebellion is the caramel lattes. The culture says, you should be thinner, stop drinking those. So that's her basic battle. So she goes back and forth, she tries to stop drinking them, then she wants them. The question that is unasked, like with the spitting kid, what is the person doing with the caramel lattes? What is so darn attractive about a caramel latte that despite all the criticism and all the people who think she's not attractive, that it still persists? That's a pretty strong power that can persist under that kind of criticism. If someone told me, David, you're no good unless you do something, and barrage me with it, I might change. But she doesn't. She continues. So one day she was in my office and I had a plastic water bottle and I said, imagine this is a caramel latte and you grab it and show me how much, when you want it and you can't stop yourself, how much you want it. So she grabs this water bottle with a fierceness. And I grab the water bottle and I say, you can't have it. And we're in a tug of war with a water bottle, right? It's a symbolic caramel latte. I say, no, you can't have it. She grabs it and she says, I want it. And we're going back and forth. And then pretty soon she starts to look pretty real, like she's in a real battle. And I said, what do you need the damn caramel lattes for? She says, I just need them. I said, why? And she says, it's my happiness. Well, that was, and then she stops, right? And we're like, wow, that's big. Tell me about being happy. And she says, now here you get the gender part, the sexism, the culture. Well, I'm taking care of kids and my husband doesn't want me to go out and follow a career, but I'm interested in finishing school and then going on to a graduate program and having a profession. But my husband doesn't really want me to do that. That would make me happy. So what she's doing with the caramel lattes, you could say, is she practicing grabbing what she wants and being relentless. Now, she should grab these other things in her life, her schooling and her career, with the same fierceness. She may have to tell her husband, which she eventually did, you know what? There are things I really want that'll make me happy in my life. I don't want to let go of those. So in that way, I call it caramel latte yoga. She's practicing. That's her practice. Right there, she's learning. And if we don't find that, Will, if we don't find what makes her happy and what the meaning of that caramel latte is, I think she'll go up and down on her weight, maybe for the rest of her life. If we do, we've relieved the caramel latte from its meaning. It's going to be much easier for her to stop drinking that because it doesn't represent the happiness of her life. It's now just a darn caramel latte. It's not sad. It's not life happiness.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and we're speaking with David Bedrick. He's a process work therapist and family law lawyer. He's the author of Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. We're talking about the psychology of power and social justice. So this is very important because this is how psychology, mainstream psychology, operates. You identify the defect and you get rid of it. It's like you see the disease, you see the illness, you see the blemish, you see the unvirtuous, the dirty part or the problematic part or the unwise part, and then you figure out ways to control it, quarantine it, and eradicate it. And this paradigm we see so much around mental health issues, around experiences that get called psychosis, but actually it's much broader than that. And your book, Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology, that's what you're tracing. You're tracing the same dynamic that repeats itself over and over and over again. Instead of seeing things as symptoms to be gotten rid of, a craving for a caramel latte, spitting, a psychotic experience, for example, instead of seeing those as things to be gotten rid of, which is what mainstream psychology does, there's a different way, which is to see them as an expression of voice that hasn't been understood or listened to.
That's a great thing. I'm thinking of a number of examples, but I'm thinking of a story that came from a Dr. Phil show. There was an African-American woman and her son, and I'm not remembering his age, but he may have been 7, 8-ish, in that range. And he was the problem that they identified that Dr. Phil was going to help with, was that he was spending a lot of time on sports and doing well at that, but not much time on what's called academics, math, English, and those kind of things. So the question was, what do we do about this youngster who is not doing very well in school, but is putting a lot of time in sports?
It's a really significant example because you see how it's laden with race implications and all the stereotypes and all the conflicts and also the realities of academic difficulties and economic inequality and family problems. And it's a very real live example. So how did Dr. Phil deal with that?
Dr. Phil wanted to convince this child and the child's mother that the child's dreams about sports, one day I'll be a Michael Jordan or whatever it would be, right? Be like Mike, I'm thinking of those commercials, that I'm going to be a great sports person, and that's going to be my way into the world as an adult. Dr. Phil tried to convince him that that's not realistic. Let me give you the statistics about how unlikely it is that you will become a professional ball player. And actually, dear youngster, you're fooling yourself. You're just taking excuses to not do your academics. And dear mom, how about a little more tough love with this child and make sure they're doing their regular homework in addition to their athletic homework?
There is some common sense element to that. There is a bit of a, well, you know, caramel lattes are not good for you. You know, focusing too much on sports is not wise for your own education. So there is a common sense element to that. And yet, how does it end up backfiring in your view?
Right. I mean, in that case, there's a very simplistic or mainstream view of what this child is doing. For instance, if you thought more about why, as you're implying, an African-American male boy in school would be interested in sports, you would think this is not only about being physical, that there's a whole history of sports being a way of succeeding, not just succeeding financially, but succeeding, getting respect, in resisting oppression and being a hero to people, in being disciplined, in being intelligent. So this child is not only finding a way of avoiding his academic interests, he knows that there is a route that society has given some room for, and some African Americans have taken that route. The Dr. Phil approach tends to think, well, that's just avoiding all the hard stuff, the discipline, the intelligence, the respect you want in life.
Let me ask you this, David. How would you respond to that family? How would you respond to African American clients or Latino clients that are grappling with this dilemma of fighting these forces that are racial and power-based forces, but that come across and meet them in very difficult ways to grasp because they do seem to be these very simple kinds of common sense sort of challenges that people see not as a racial issue? How do you engage with them in that way?
I mean, if I were with that mother and her child, I would have had a context in my mind. But the first thing I would have done with that child, I would say, you're spending a lot of time with sports. Tell me about sports. Because there's probably all kinds of wonderful qualities. Discipline, intelligence, pride, going for respect, wanting to be a success in life. There's probably all kinds of wonderful qualities that I don't want to throw out in this kid by saying that whole thing is bad. I may not notice that I'm actually throwing out exactly the kind of qualities, capacities, motivations that I actually need. If this child has got intelligence in there, passion in there, dreams about where they can go in their life through sports, I don't want to drop that too quickly.
That brings us back to the example of the caramel latte. Look, there's a whole story of happiness in that caramel latte, or the example of the kid that's spitting. Look, there's a whole story of discrimination and being mistreated by an oppressive bus driver in that story that would be missed if we just see this as something we have to get rid of and not talk about.
That's right. And then we need to, and then as you are doing so well and we're doing together, is some kind of education of the public, so that if I could have my show, I guess, and done that, I would have wanted to use that as an opportunity to not reinforce those kind of racial prejudices and biases and blindnesses to the audience, but educate people about that. For instance, that mother, what kind of predicament she really is in, what kind of schools this kid is in, so that we have also a heart or a compassion for that predicament, and not only the judgment that we're likely to walk away with.
Well, how do we avoid the pitfall of being politically correct and just sort of taking a high ground of denouncing racism and, you know, using an individual's story as kind of like a flag to be against a system, especially as people with white skin privilege, as you and I are? I mean, basically most people who have the privilege of whiteness in this culture just don't even talk about this kind of issue, you know, and if you do talk about it, you're going to get into arguments, going to get, you know, there's going to be hurt feelings, it's going to be complicated, it's going to be messy, it's much easier to just kind of avoid it. But what do you think are the responsibilities that people with privilege have in order to really grapple with these things, and also especially people who are involved in the mental health system, maybe working as therapists or working as peers or wanting to just help each other? What kinds of responsibilities do we have to engage our own privilege, and how do we do it in a way that's just not a simplistic kind of politically correct framework that ends up making us just feel guilty or just kind of hammering each other in a back and forth tug of war that doesn't feel like it goes anywhere?
It's a great question. I don't think I have an answer, but I have ideas and things that I've seen that are helpful. And one thing I've seen helpful is when people look at their own personal or ethnic or cultural story and get to know something about what that condition is like, what it's like to be smaller or less powerful, whether that's as a child or as a woman or as a Jewish person or as a whatever it is that you can grab a hold of, or just your own experiences, what it's like to feel not understood, to feel put down in some way, to feel like people don't get it, and what the cost is, what the pain is inside, and the anger and all the different emotions around that. When people are in touch with that for themselves, they tend to be more likely to get it when they see it happening in another person.
Can you give us an example of how that might work out? Because I think that's a really important thing that you're saying about, look, all of us need to get in touch with the ways that we've felt oppressed, that we've felt put down and stepped on, times in our lives when we didn't have a voice. That's a very interesting way of challenging us, to get us to not, you know, not necessarily see ourselves as the bad guy, but see ourselves as somebody who's been on the receiving end. How what's an example of how that would play out for people?
Here's something I know from my counseling practices. This wouldn't be the right direction for everybody, but if a person has been hurt as a child, then here's what I know from helping that person. Let's say there's a person who as a child got hurt by one parent. Let's say that's a father. Let's say it was a physical hurt, a physical assault, an abuse, we'd call it, right? If I talk to that person about that and they're open to saying something about that, and I ask this question, Will, who was there? Who wasn't there? Who dismissed what happened to you? Did the school not notice? Did the mother not notice? Did nobody know? And what happens to that person? That person is likely to walk around thinking, well, something was wrong with me. Something screwed up about me. That paradigm, being hurt and having somebody who doesn't get it, people can get that story, and that's a similar story that they can lay on to other things. For instance, there's an African American person. That person is having a hard time in school. How are we not seeing the context of that particular difficulty? How are we the witnesses who are now not seeing that a person has been injured and not really witnessing back something difficult?
What you're suggesting is that we need to have conversations from places of mutual vulnerability, that we need to see the ways in which we were not heard, that we weren't listened to, that we didn't get the support that we needed, and then to understand that that's what other people need, that you know, young people need that, that people who are suffering with dieting need that, people who are feeling like they're falling behind and they don't have the privileges that white skin might give them in that situation. People need a sense of a witnessing and a listening to and a being with their vulnerabilities around that pain. And David, where have you been bringing this perspective in your work? I know you're also involved, as well as a therapist, you're also involved as a teacher. Tell us a little bit more about the work that you're doing around privilege and social justice issues and power issues.
There's a few major ways that I try to continue my work. I teach doing classes and workshops, some things. Sometimes it's on social issues, sometimes it's on ethics for counselors. And then I do a private practice there also. I try to engage people in their inside life, as it were, or the relationship life. And then I do regular writing for Huffington Post and Psychology Today. So in all these arenas, I try to take a look at the dilemmas that individuals or groups bring and try to bring this perspective. What's going on? What are the voices unseen or unheard? And if I can bring those out, how does that edify us about the situation and how to make some healing?
And how can people get in touch with you to find out more about your work?
The best website would be talkingbacktodrphil.com. So it's talkingbacktodrphil.com, and there they can find out about me and my practice. They can reach me. They can get links to listen to videos or audio about things I've lectured on. They can get links to a lot of the things I've written, excerpts to the book, etc.
David Bedrick, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Awesome. Awesome, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with David Bedrick. He's a process work therapist with a background in family law as a lawyer. He's a writer and teacher and has a column on the Huffington Post website as well as for Psychology Today. He's the author of the new book, Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
Songs are like tattoos.
This is Ed Melnick inviting you to join me for a special focus on early Joni Mitchell. Joining me for some Joni talk will be singer-songwriters Ann Weiss, Bree Gregg, and Sue Zalikar. 3 p.m. this Monday, November 4th, on the singer-songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler.
Call me at the station. The lights are open.
You're tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. It's time now for the headline news.
With your KBOO noon news headlines, I'm Jimmy Tardy. A review of CIA practices following the attacks on September 11, 2001 concludes that health professionals working for the agency, quote, designed and participated in cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment and torture of detainees. Encouraged to ignore their Hippocratic Oath due to the fact that they were not treating people who were sick, doctors and nurses were required to participate in force feedings of prisoners on hunger strikes. The review of health professional practices in association with the Department of Defense and CIA, titled Ethics Abandon Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror, was conducted by the Institute on Medicine as a Profession and the Open Society Foundation. Voters go to the polls in Virginia and New Jersey tomorrow to elect governors in both states. The races are highlighting splits among the GOP, with former presidential candidate Mitt Romney campaigning for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, while U.S. Senators Mark Rubio and Rand Paul have been stumping for Virginia gubernatorial candidate Ken Cuccinelli. The race in New Jersey appears heavily in favor of Christie, while polls in Virginia indicate that former Democratic National Campaign Chair Terry McAuliffe is the favorite with less than 48 hours to go. Mohamed Morsi, deposed as president of Egypt by the Egyptian military earlier this year, was defiant as he entered court to stand trial today for incitement to murder. Morsi's first words in public after being held in secret detention for the past 4 months were, quote, "What is happening now is a military coup. I am furious that the Egyptian judiciary should serve as cover for this criminal military coup." The trial was suspended after chaos broke out in the courtroom, with several of Morsi's co-defendants chanting against the military, local journalists demanding that Morsi be executed, and fistfights breaking out between government and defense trial lawyers. The trial has been adjourned until after the new year. After becoming the first head of state to be found guilty of genocide in his own country's courts and then having his verdict vacated by an appeals court, the fate of former Guatemalan dictator José Efrén Ríos Montt will be considered by an international court beginning this week. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington will consider a petition being filed by representatives of Guatemala's Ixil people, who will be joined by the lead prosecutor for the Guatemala trial, Edgar Perez. The petitioners hope to put pressure on the Guatemalan courts to reinstate the verdict along with Montt's 80-year prison sentence. Tune in every weekday at 5 p.m. for the volunteer-produced KBOO evening news broadcast. For KBOO News, I'm Jimmy Tardy. This is KBO Portland.